Okay, well, thank you for being here in the first place, but for me being here, and I don't know about you, but for me being here is a good thing, and for asking me to give a talk. I also would like to thank the organizers for giving me a very nice office with a great view. The only defect I found here is that it probably has the largest distance to the espresso machine in the building. Well, maybe not. So the previous talk, beautiful talk actually on nematicity, actually is one of the, by the way, it's one of the best studies I've seen of nematicity in electronic systems in quite some time. So this is really, it was a real pleasure to see. So this will be not about facts, but about interpretation facts. So it's about intertwined orders in high temperature superconductors. This is work that I have been doing over quite some time, primarily with Steve Kivelson. The work that I will summarize today here, it comes from a recent paper we wrote with Steve and with John Tranquada, and it was posted over a month ago in the archive. Presumably will appear in the Review of Modern Physics at some point, I hope. A lot of this work was done earlier with Ernst Berg, Ronin, Mogelesian, Unakim, Michael Moller, Daniel Varsi, and Roger Fari, and my student, Sotomayor. So the question is, so you will see that I will not say much about the aerial superconductors. I am a corporate kind of person, and so I will. So some of the aspects of what I'm going to talk about, I believe, are applicable as well to the case of the aerial superconductors, but I'm not entirely sure if all of them do. So we'll see that as we go along. So the question is, why is high TC different, in particular in the context of the cuprates? One of the aspects, and this is the one that probably doesn't always extend in the case of the aerial superconductors, is that they are strongly quasi-two-dimensional materials. The normal phase is not a good metal. The electronic quasi-particles are not well defined in the high temperature phase. And the superconductivity, in some sense, appears at low temperatures out of a phase that doesn't really have well-defined quasi-particles. And that's a very important distinction from many of the conventional systems. The dominant interactions are repulsive. There are, of course, always electron-phonon couplings. They're always there. In you and me and everybody here, the electron-phonon couplings. We don't become superconductors because of that necessarily. But in this case, the dominant interactions are repulsive. The superconductivity, on the other hand, arises typically from doping, in the case of the high temperature, the cuprates case, a strongly correlated MOT insulator, which is typically an interferometer. And in addition to that, a host of other ordered or almost ordered phases are also seen. So this is sort of the picture of what the problem looks like. A good number of years ago, back in 1998, with Steve Kivelson and with Vic Emery, we conjectured that if you dope a MOT insulator, there's a strong tendency to phase separation in the system, which is seen in microscopic calculations of rather small systems. And then that typically would produce essentially a crystal of doped holes. And you, of course, you could melt the crystal directly into a superconducting state, but you could go through a sequence of phase transitions, quantum or thermal, in which you could go, say, by restoring various degrees of symmetries, you could go through a stripe or symmetric phase, a nematic state, or an isotropic state. So the symmetric phase breaks translation invariance only in one direction and is metallic. The nematic state here could be a metal or a superconductor. It could also be an insulator, in this instance it's not. But it's a system which is translational invariant but breaks rotational invariance. In a lattice system, the rotational symmetry is essentially that what he's talking about is a point group symmetry of the lattice, so the symmetry that is broken is actually discrete. So when we refer to nematicity, we refer essentially to the spontaneous breaking of rotational invariance, not to any particular mechanism by which this could happen, whether it's a Pomeranchuk instability, whether it's by melting stripes, whether it's by orbital ordering. There are many possible mechanisms that could give rise to anisotropic phases. The same is true with the other ones. So here, what we have in mind is the idea that you could proliferate essentially dislocations of this triposmectic phase, which essentially will restore translation invariance, but will retain a broken orientational symmetry. Okay, so these are the dislocations of the smectic, essentially. And then eventually, in the isotropic phase, the system is fully isotropic and unified. Now, in that paper back in 1998, we also gave an argument that if the stripes came equipped with something like a spring gap, then in fact that spring gap could become, in fact, a superconducting state in a two-dimensional case, and then as a function of some parameter that essentially measures the strength of the quantum fluctuations of the structure, so we put h bar as a parameter here, then the TC of the superconductor actually could grow as you went into the more homogeneous phases. Okay. And so the big question that we did not answer at the time is how are these sort of electronic liquid crystal phases, which we sort of proposed based on an analogy, if you wish, with the classical systems, how are they related to superconductivity? Are they part of the mechanism of the superconductor, are they part of, or are they a problem for the superconductor? So normally people would like to go straight from here to there, essentially without any of these intervening issues. What we have seen in the past few years, in fact, that this sort of phase diagram that we did not derive, we just drew it, is in fact what is seen in the experiment. And so here is essentially the more recent version of the same phase diagram, inspired on the current status of, as of 2012, of interim-barium copper oxide. And there what one sees is essentially high temperature bad metal phase. Essentially this is the regime where there are no quasi-particles. There is some regime presumably associated with T-star, where there is some mesoscale electronic phase separation that results in an electromagnetic, an incipient charge density wave or stripe phase, and eventually a D-wave superconductor here with some spin glass and so on. And this is based on observations that have been essentially building up, in particular in this material, over the years. This was supposed to be the material where none of this actually happened. So this material that people swore by their grandmothers and maybe a few other things, that none of these other so-called competing orders actually existed, and only you had essentially the antiferromagnet and the superconductor and nothing else. And now we know, okay, actually the forerunner of this is this shoulder here in TC, in the TC of the superconductor, which was identified this particular point here as the so-called 1/8 anomaly by Bohm and Hardy quite a number of years ago, by comparing essentially with the behavior of the lanthanum series of the superconductor. Inelastic neutron scattering finds pneumatic order essentially roughly here at the end of the plateau, and the pneumaticity appears at about 150 Kelvin or so. NMR in high fields.
What's Y?
Y is what is sometimes called X or sometimes called delta, is doping. Essentially, Y is because yttrium is essentially. Six, so Y should be 0.45, I'm sorry. So this is 6 points. So sometimes called 6 plus Y or 7 minus delta. So essentially doping.
What does TCN mean?
TC of the pneumatic.
It's a crossover scale.
No, it's actually, well, okay. What they see.
There's change in YBCO.
Yeah, there is change. So essentially similar to what actually we saw for the pneumaticity in the previous talk. What you see is essentially the system has a broken symmetry already, is orthorhombic, and so there is an increase of the anisotropy, which is strongly temperature dependent, that rises over that background that is essentially temperature independent. So the chains, or what's left of them by in this regime over here, essentially act as an aligning field, as a symmetry breaking field. Okay? So there's some weak anisotropy, weak orthorhombicity that is acting as a symmetry breaking field. So this is what was seen essentially in this in elastic neutron scattering experiments. The Bragg peaks essentially, rather the Pi peak, became very strongly anisotropic and temperature dependent and energy dependent. NMR and high fields found a charge-like stripe signature in agreement with the quantum oscillation experiments, the Hassan Alfen. In that case, the teeth seems associated for this phenomenology essentially was something like 60 Kelvin. More recent, well, actually, the transport there were transport experiments way back in 2002 by Ando, who saw the transport anisotropy in resistivity. And more recently, the Peltier experiments by the Sherbrooke group, this is Louis Taillefer, where they see actually quite clear nematicity in the pseudogap regime pretty much everywhere, ranging from the optimal doping to the underdog regime. Okay. So this is sort of in the high temperature regime of that. And they basically start at temperatures of the order of 150 Kelvin or so. That's a typical value. More recently, charge stripe order. When people say stripe here, they mean unidirectional versus bidirectional, which is sometimes called checkerboard in this game. That's all there is to it. So they do this with inelastic X-ray scattering and also with X-ray diffraction. And more recently, also in ultrasound anomalies, they also find stripe-like charge order near the so-called 1/8 anomaly, which is essentially this region. This is the so-called ortho 2 sample. So all of these results, essentially, the one aspect of this is not only that these other phases are seen, but they all seem to have critical temperatures which are quite comparable to each other and quite comparable with the critical temperature of the superconductivity itself. The only big critical temperature here is the interferomagnetism. Everything else seems to have more or less TC of the same sort. When you suppress one phase, you get a big phase coming up. Okay, so this is going to be a theme in what I'm going to talk about. Why is that happening, and why is that an important issue?
I have a question.
Okay. Yes.
The first CW measure is the 3 Kelvin. Is it a different X?
Sorry?
Last experiment you mentioned, is the TC.
Yeah, the 1/8 essentially is this feature here.
And the,
what
is the doping for the NMR?
The NMR are also in the same regime, essentially. So there are essentially two different, there are two, well, but they also, so this is done at high fields.
Okay.
This is done at zero field and so on. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the important issue is that it's not that you have to go to 1 degree Kelvin and the other is 100 degrees or something like that. They're all these phases seem to come with the same strength, roughly speaking. Sorry? It's about 90 degrees in this material. That's the prototype. Is this supposed to be the very best material according to UBC people? So the way we normally think about this is by what is called the so-called competing order scenario, which I would like to offer a critique of. So if you do essentially analyze, if you analyze this using the Landau theory of phase transition, you say, well, I have a whole bunch of order parameters. I just write down my Landau expansion in powers of the strength of the order parameter. Okay, and the problem when you do that is that unless you fine-tune to some, just look at how many phases I have here. I have a pneumatic state. I have a charge density wave. I have, in the other cases, in the lanthanum compound, there's also a spin stripe. Then you have the superconductivity, and so on and so forth. So I have a good number of other parameters. I have a fairly complicated free energy with lots of terms. And if you are going to believe that in the Landau theory that all of these other parameters have a TC which is about the same, you will have to be extremely lucky to be very close to some complicated multicritical point. Okay, and I will show you an example of a free energy of that type. And the problem is that this is not what the systems are doing. You go from one series of the couplets to another series of the couplet, and the same phenomenology is present as you vary x and so on, as you dope. And the TCs are all more or less the same, so why is that the case? So that doesn't seem to be that they are competing. More it seems to us that they are actually growing together. And that's why we decided to change the word, and instead of calling them competing orders, we'd like to call them intertwined. If you have another word you prefer, it's fine with me. But the fact is that they appear to grow together rather than competing with each other. Okay, so that's, in a sense, a reading of the experiments. Okay? So the question is, why does this happen? So there is a strong hint in my mind. One of these comes from the observer electronic inhomogeneity that is seen, say, for instance, in STM, where they see local stripe and pneumatic order. The stripe order usually shorter range than the pneumatic order that is seen in both. We see it in explicit detail in another material, the disco. That's the only one where the STM experiments can be done. And they see it over a broad range of temperatures, voltage, and fields. And so this is a rather interesting effect. So it appears that the physics of this has to do with this electronic inhomogeneity, the tendency of the system to nucleate all of these phases at the same time. And it's trying to find some optimal balance between them. This phenomenology is natural from the point of view that one is doping and not insulator. In a sense, you tend to phase separate, and this phase separation is frustrated by the Coulomb interactions and by the kinetic energy of the holes as well. So in that sense, it's possible that this scenario of electronic liquid crystal phases may actually be essentially an important part of this interpretation of the problem. I want to note, and this is particularly apropos of the program, but in particular given the talk we just heard, that some of these phases are also seen in the iron superconductors, and they're also seen in heavy fermions, but although in a more limited way. So let me discuss a particular material. This is in the lanthanum series. This is the original high-temperature superconductor, lanthanum barium copper oxide. This is where HTC was discovered in 1986. I'll show in a moment what the phase diagram. Actually, let me show you the phase diagram now. It's here. So the phase diagram is this. So as you dope the system, X is the amount of lanthanum versus barium. So as you dope, there is a famous 1/8 anomaly where TC is suppressed down to about 4 Kelvin or less, depending on the sample. The maximum TC is much lower than in YBCO. It's about 35 degrees or so. And there are two lobes, and there is this deep minimum, and this is where static stripe order, both in charge and spin, was first observed experimentally. And people said, well, if you look at this, so here too there is a structural transition that happens to coincide with the charge ordering transition. In the European dope LSEO, they are split, but here they are together. So when people saw this, they said, well, you see charge order and spin order is clearly the enemy of superconductivity because TC is strongly suppressed where that happens. You see only so-called fluctuating stripes in these other regimes inside the superconducting domes. When people say fluctuating stripes, it's like being half pregnant. So what they mean is that they see low energy fluctuations, low compared to the scale of the superconducting gap, so it looks like it's an almost order state. So you're quite close to a phase transition where they will order, and when they seem to order, they do this. Now, there is an interesting discovery by the Brookhaven group. This is Li et al. Back in 2007. They analyzed the transport data. Actually, I'm only showing the resistivity here. They also looked at thermoelectric factor effects, etc., which I will not discuss. So they actually sat here where the charge and spin order are seen. So the resistivity ratio between the C-axis and the AV plane, which is in this regime here, is actually perfectly isotropic and tetragonal, is a factor of 2,000. When the charge order occurs, they begin to split. So in fact, what happens is that the C-axis resistivity continues to rise as you lower the temperature, but the AV plane resistivity appears to be rather flat. As soon as the spin ordering temperature is reached, which is at about 42 Kelvin, which is about here, the spin ordering, the in-plane resistivity begins to drop rapidly, and the C-axis resistivity continues to grow. So you begin to get this much bigger ratio of the two resistivities. Below 35 Kelvin, you see very strong in-plane superconducting fluctuations, whereas the C-axis continues to be quite resistive. And by the time you reach 16 Kelvin or 18 Kelvin, again depending on the sample, the in-plane resistivity is essentially zero, whereas the C-axis resistivity is still fairly large. So in other words, below this temperature, which is about here, so here you have a great deal of fluctuations in-plane of the superconductivity. Here what you see, apparently you have a bunch of two-dimensional superconductors that are not talking to each other. And you say, well, you see that, you say something is wrong here in this experiment. If you have a bunch of two-dimensional planes which are superconducting, there should be a Josephson effect that will couple them together and will drive it into three-dimensional superconductors. However, the three-dimensional superconductivity is not seen until much lower temperatures. So, for instance, a resistive transition where the rho C goes to zero happens at 10 Kelvin, and you don't see a full flux expulsion. In other words, you don't reach the Meissner state. Something like this. Until 4 Kelvin or so, or even below. Okay. So, and this is also rather anomalous. In most superconductors, once you reach the resistive transition, you also reach the Meissner state. They usually coincide. So here they don't. So all of these anomalies seem to indicate that there is some sort of two-dimensional superconductivity that survives in all of this regime, and only becomes three-dimensional, in that sense, probably a uniform D-wave at a much lower temperature. But it's not that there is no superconductivity here. In fact, it seems to be quite robust in some sense. So another experiment that is interesting to compare with is more recent, from 2010. This is from Basov's group. They compare the superfluid density and the C-axis measured from reflectivity. This is the so-called Josephson resonance experiment with the extrapolated value of the VC conductivity as you extrapolate to low temperatures. For a large number of materials, you can see neodymium, doped LSCO, LVCO, and many others. Actually, this straight line that they find here, this is also obeyed by the so-called BCS superconductors. They also satisfy that. However, in all these other materials, if you apply an external magnetic field and you go in the under Rope regime, then you immediately depart from this linear relationship and you basically lose the superfluid density along the C-axis very quickly. So it was known, for instance, from neutron scattering back in 2002, this is Bela Lake and collaborators, that in this regime here, as a function of magnetic field, you had a so-called magnetic field-induced spin density wave, in other words, a so-called stripe state. And it appears to display the same phenomenology that essentially one is seen here in LBCO precisely at that point. More recent experiments by the Brookhaven group essentially found the same effects here by applying a magnetic field. These type of experiments have not been done in LBCOs, in YBCO, so far as I know. So we like to call this effect dynamical layer decoupling. So it is as if there is some broad range over which, for some reason, the planes are superconducting, but the superconductivity doesn't propagate from plane to plane. The question is, why? So we proposed some years ago, this is a paper with Eric and his collaborators, that maybe what happens is that the superconductivity itself became striped. In other words, there is an inhomogeneous superconductor, and we proposed that this should be some essentially a version of the Larkin-Ovchinnikov state where the order parameter is oscillatory. Okay. But instead of being due to an external magnetic field, as in the old proposal by Larkin and Ovchinnikov, this is the result of this frustrated phase separation. Regions which locally look the wave-like, so for instance here this will be a region that looks like the wave, and here also looks like the wave but with the axis rotated relative to each other, which is to say another parameter change sign. In this particular case, there is a charge modulation that comes with it, and there is also in the particular proposal we had at the time, because of LBCO, we essentially associated that with a spin stripe as well. So this may or may not have that component. So in this type of state, by symmetry, you cannot have a direct Josephson effect. The leading Josephson effect is forbidden by symmetry. You can have a second order Josephson effect of tunneling of pairs, but no tunneling of pairs. So a state of this type would certainly explain many of the features, as you will see, that arise in this so-called competing state. So the proposal is that the quote competing state, the one that competes with the uniform superconductor, is also superconducting. And the advantage of this is that it's a good candidate for a pseudo gap because it has a gap. Okay, and like other proposals for a pseudo gap that we have seen, including nematicity, nematicity alone cannot explain a pseudo gap because if you simply induce an anisotropy, this doesn't actually produce a gap in uniformity surface or anything like that. Whereas these type of states are actually, even if you just arise locally, they essentially are good for producing a pseudo gap type behavior. Okay, so let me tell you the Landau-Ginzburg theory is a kind of a striped superconductor, or the pure density wave as we like to call it. So you start with the order parameter of the superconductor, which is a complex field, which has an amplitude on the phase. And if you expand this in Fourier components, now you have instead of one order parameter, you have two, because you have the Fourier component near the wave vector Q, and the Fourier component near the wave vector minus Q, and they are no longer, they are not the complex conjugate of each other, because this is the Fourier transform of a complex object to begin with. So here you don't have essentially one complex order parameter, you have two complex order parameters instead of one. So you have two amplitudes and two phases. Okay, and this actually will be quite important in what I'm going to say now. Of course, you break translation symmetry, you also break rotation invariance, so it's automatically pneumatic. Of course, it's maximally pneumatic in this case. There is also a charge stripe you can define, which is a charge sensitive wave at wave vector k. Okay, we'll see in a moment that k cannot be arbitrary. You can also define a spin stripe, which is a Fourier component, the Fourier transform of the spin density with wave vector q. And you will see in a moment that there is a natural relationship between k and q that has to be satisfied. So in this sense, these order parameters are also intertwined in the sense that the wave vectors are not arbitrary. In a conventional system, we have a charge density wave that coexists with a superconductor, say, in a dipole cogenide. There is no particular value of the wave vector that is actually associated with the superconductivity. Here it is. So let me write down the Landau-Ginzburg free energy. Well, the usual quadratic terms and the usual quartic terms that you need for stability, let me not bore you with that. There are some very interesting cubic terms, and this I want to focus on them. So for instance, I can write a term that relates the spin stripe and the charge density rate, the charge stripe, and if you want to impose the C2 invariance for the spins, and you want to impose translation invariance as well, then k and q have to be related by the condition k equals to 2q. The same analysis can be done by relating the charge density wave with a pair density wave, this modulated superconductor. But now I need to make sure that the system is gauge invariant instead, but k still is equal to 2q. So there is a natural relationship between these wave vectors. And similarly for the nematicity, let me not deal with that at the moment. So if I try to get to a point where all of these other parameters have TCs which are comparable to each other, I will have to essentially fine-tune all of the coefficients of the quadratic term, all of the coefficients of the many of the coefficients of the partic term, and so on, to some state of maximal symmetry. This is a little bit like the old SO5 theory of Such and Zhang's. Here will be SO10 if you count, or even more. Okay? And the problem with that is that you will have to be extremely lucky to find a system that obeys essentially this fine-tuning, let alone to find a whole bunch of different systems that they all want to have very close to this complicated multicritical point. And that, to me, is unnatural. Okay, and this is the question that I want to raise. So how does this, aside from this question, which I will discuss in a moment, how does the state actually explain part of the physics? Well, one is already seen, k equals to 2q. This is seen in the experiments, in the neutron scattering experiments, is seen very clearly. So the spin density wave and the charge density wave are actually related by this much. This state actually doesn't have nodes. It's not a nodal state. It has Bourgeois of quasi-particles that form pockets because you break translation symmetry. And Catherine Cutting and one of our deputy directors have done a very detailed study of this behavior, which will be important in what I'm going to say in a moment. Actually, once you allow for the state to have an ordering wave vector q, you can form another trilinear term that involves delta q and delta minus q. This is not gauge invariant, but if I add a uniform component that has charge 4e, then I can restore gauge invariance. In other words, you induce automatically a uniform component that looks like a condensation not of pairs, but of quartets, okay, or pairs of pairs.
What's the name of the order quartet?
Essentially, it's an order parameter which is quartic in fermions. It's not a pair of field, it's a pair of pairs, if you want. Normally, such order parameters are unstable because you can always decay to the simpler ones. Here, by translation invariance, you can't. Okay, so it's not. So this is a subsidiary, if you want, order parameter which necessarily will be present. Now, because it breaks translation symmetry, now this state can couple strongly to a disorder, actually. So it's a fragile state. Unlike the uniform superconductor, which by gauge invariance cannot couple to disorder in a strong way, you can modulate the amplitude, but the phase essentially cannot couple to that. The relative phase, in fact, here can couple to disorder. So this actually may explain some of the physics. If you now add a uniform component, the usual charge to a superconductor, you can now have another trilinear term that relates the superconductivity, the pair density wave, and the charge density wave, but now they have to have the same wave vector. So the prediction is that if you enter the uniform superconducting state, the conventional uniform state, there should be an additional component in the charge order with the same ordering wave vector as the pair density wave. So in other words, it's not k equals to 2q, but k equals q. So this is and also it will remove the sensitivity to disorder, so it will be in that sense more robust. Okay? So there are a number of things here that can be falsified, as you can see, of this proposal. So it's a strongly layered system, so what can we say about the phase transitions, the thermal transitions? Well, let me go to, it's a quasi-two-dimensional system, let me assume that the phase fluctuations play a key role in the thermal transitions, so we're going to do costly Stavlitz theory. But I have a more complicated system than before. Instead of a single phase field, I have two phase fields. So I can make, essentially, from the two phase fields, I can make an average phase, which I call theta plus, and a relative phase, which I will call phi, which looks, for practical purposes, like the phase field of a charge density wave. So there will be two stiffnesses, rho s, essentially the superfluid density for the superfluidity, for the superconductivity, and there will be a CDW, if you wish, a stiffness, which I will call kappa. I can now try to analyze what type of vortices I can make. Well, there are, in this system, I can have several types of topological excitations. I can make certainly the conventional 2-pi vortices that don't induce essentially any singularity in the charge order, which is here. I can also introduce a double dislocation of the charge order, which gives me a change of phi in 4 pi, but doesn't affect the superconductivity. But now I can have another state, which is a half vortex, essentially, of the superconductivity coupled to a single dislocation of the charge order. And to see a picture of that, you can see it here. So imagine that you have the pair density wave, delta changes from plus to minus to plus to minus, or if you want the phase goes from 0 to pi, so 0 to pi, etc. If I introduce a single dislocation, there is a pi mismatch of the phase, and therefore this looks like a pi vortex. What this is saying is that this phase actually has a violation of the of the vortex quantization condition is not hc over 2e, but hc over 4e, due to this type of singularities, which can be induced by disorder. They can also be induced thermally. So this actually gives me a more interesting pathway for melting. I can either melt a system by proliferating the superconductive vortices. I can restore translation invariance by proliferating my double dislocations. Or I can proliferate this sort of bound state, the half vortex, which is coupled to the single dislocations. Again, these are dislocations not of the structure. These are dislocations of the charge order, I want to insist. This is not a structural feature.
Can
you
have
a people like
three
bone thing? No. It's quartic. So 2.4, 1, 2. Yeah. You'll see in a moment what it is. So these are the ones that are allowed essentially by symmetry in this case. You cannot have three.
You
cannot
have one to charge, but by itself.
Well, the charge is automatically there because the phase field couples essentially is locked to the charge density wave. So in other words, even if I have a pair density wave alone, it induces a charge density wave. So it's already there. Okay. So the way you do the thermal transition is by the usual Kostal Stalnitz argument. You want to see when these things proliferate. In other words, if you want to have some free energy gain, what you need to do is to compute the scaling dimension of each one of these objects. And the simple calculation that goes back to kindergarten essentially tells you that it's inversely proportional to the temperature, but it's linearly proportional to the rho s for the superconductor and the superfluid and the stiffness of the CW. And p and q here are these topological quantum numbers. So you have a whole bunch of phases that can result, and let me show you what they are. So you could have a striped superconductor where you coexist the uniform component with a pair density wave. Let me ignore this for a moment. You could have a higher temperature phase here where you have this pair density wave with power law correlations because you're in two dimensions. You can melt this by essentially proliferating vortices. This gets rid of the superconductivity but doesn't restore the charge order, does not melt the charge order. That will come by proliferating the dislocations again. You could also proliferate the double dislocations that restores translation invariance, leaving behind a uniform charge for each superconductor. And then you can subsequently, by essentially proliferating the half vortices, you can go to the nematic phase, or you can go straight into the nematic phase, which will be the high temperature phase of this state. I say nematic because I assume you need directional order. To restore bidirectional order or a full isotropy, you need a subsequent higher temperature transition. So what are the parameters here? The parameters are the ratio of the superfluid of the stiffness of the charge density wave with the superfluid density of this pair density wave and the temperature. So notice that now I don't need to fine-tune to a particular very close to a multicritical point. I have all of these marginal operators in the technical language that allows me essentially to blow up the phase diagram onto some broad range where all of these phases have TCs which are similar to each other. So quasi-two-dimensionality helps. That's the moral of this. And having all of these complex set of phases arises naturally if you assume that you have inhomogeneous superconductivity in the system to begin with. So if you assume that this pair density wave is actually the explanation of the layer of the coupling, this actually gives you a rationale for the complex phase diagrams that we see in this type of system. Yes? Sorry? So kappa is the stiffness of the phase field of the density, of the charge density wave. So that, of course, is a microscopic parameter that will vary from material to material, okay, and will vary with opening, but it will vary smoothly.
Okay. But that stiffness you're saying comes because you define it as a difference between the phases of the complex 4E.
Right, so each one of the other parameters will have a prefactor, which will have its separate stiffness, essentially. So LBCO presumably is here in this phase diagram, where you essentially go from the low temperature uniform superconducting state through this intermediate phase, I'd like to call it the pure density wave, to the charge-order, purely charge-order phase, and some higher temperature phase. And I didn't put the spin part here just for simplicity. Yes?
So you don't have a PDW at zero temperature, but
it could have made it stable? It could. There is also another question. I'll come to some of the microscopics in a moment. Okay? Yes?
So that is explain the phase with zero resistance but no temperature?
That's my opinion. I have not done a real theory of that, but this is potentially a good way to explain it. Because you could imagine that what the disorder does in the system is essentially to nucleate these defects. And therefore, in a sense, the disorder could have already produced some flux in the system, so it's already penetrated, so to speak. So presumably this will allow, so once you go into the uniform phase, these things will be confined to each other. There will be a linear energy cost associated with them. Instead of logarithmic, but in the uniform phase they are suppressed, they are strongly suppressed. But if you are in this other regime, the disorder presumably can give you this type of phase, so it could give you a vanishing resistivity in the C-axis without actually having a mass flow effect. So in other words, this will induce some kind of gauge glass, if you want to call it. Okay. That's the interpretation. But there is no real theory of that. These are just words. Okay. This, essentially, if you see essentially half vortices of this type, or essentially any vorticity that is naturally attached to a dislocation of the charge order, that's one of them. The other is a violation of the flux quantization condition. You can also do the usual Josephson corner experiments, essentially, to look for this. Yes. So some of these experiments are being done. The other is whether or not you see this additional component of the charge order inside the uniform phase, arising in the uniform phase. So it has several, you know, it's just symmetry analysis, but it has predictive power, as you can see.
In practice, that's it. I want to have half-vortex.
Yes.
Yes.
Actually, in STM, they do see things like this, in the sense that they do see single dislocations.
Right.
What they haven't done is the analog of looking for some kind of vortex structure associated with them. Now, this is done typically deep inside the superconducting state in BISCO. So presumably, if there is any vorticity associated with that, it will require some nearby anti-dislocation so that the things will not be strongly suppressed. They will have to go probably very close to the system is about to exit the superconducting phase, so that the uniform component is weak enough to allow for this. But they are seen. If you look at the data from the Cornell group, you will see the things very clearly. Okay. So this type of order is natural to explain the concept of intertwined order, if you want, because it is already intertwined itself. How much time do I have left? Negative? Let me summarize with some comments on microscopic models. There is very little done, actually, on microscopic models of these type of orders, because it's actually kind of hard. If you try to do BCS, you encounter the problem that you break the nesting condition, and so unless you are very close to where, I mean, in the old way, in the way Larkin and Ovchinnikov or Fulde-Ferrer, which is a time reversal breaking version of this, conceived this back in 1964, they needed a weak Zeeman coupling for this to happen. And this state, by the way, in a weak Zeeman coupling has never been seen. There have been lots of sightings and then disappeared. So the proposal here is this arises essentially out of this solving this frustration problem. The system solves its existential issues by forming this state. And typically, the coupling now will have to be large. If you do a BCS analysis, the group by Kampf and collaborators have done this. They have very nice results. The problem is very unclear, since essentially the critical couplings are of the order of the bandwidth. It's unclear how much you're supposed to believe from that, in the sense many other things could have happened before. So that's a problem. because this uses the recoupling theory, so it cannot address this type of strongly coupled states. It arises naturally in quasi-one-dimensional systems, for instance, in the 1D Kondo-Heisenberg chain with Eres and Steve. We did a, well, Eres did a DMRG simulation. I didn't do any DMRG simulation. And there it turns out that the so-called Kondo singlet phase that has been known to exist for a long time in this one-dimensional system. This is not in the insulating state, it's in the conducting state, in the superconducting state, in fact. In that regime, it turns out that the pair density wave is very robust, and it's one of the orders that people have identified, but they just given it a different name. It has exactly this character. More recently, with my student Jafari, we showed that this also appears in the spin-up phase of two leg ladders in some regimes. And very recently, we looked at the variant of the pneumatic phase, essentially in the triplet channel. If you stay very close to a quantum critical point of that, you can induce essentially these type of states. But in the sort of quasi one-dimensional world, things actually look better. And let me show you essentially this transparency. And this, I can do two transparencies and then I'll quit. So if you take essentially a bunch of Hubbard-Heisenberg ladders, and I assume that each one of them has a spin gap and looks like one-dimensional superconductor, a D-wave superconductor, and then you look at how they couple to each other, you can ask what kind of two-dimensional state do you obtain? And it's known that in that limit there are two relevant perturbations. One is the coupling between the charge density waves in the individual ladders, and the other is the coupling, the Josephson coupling between the two ladders. So if you analyze what happens as a function, if you just do the RG, well, you'd say, well, maybe the leading, the more relevant operator wins. And it's true in some regime, so at small x, the superconductor wins in that case. At some large value of x, the charge density wave wins. But it turns out that there is an intermediate regime where they appear to compete. And you don't know whether you have a straight Forstoid transition with a bicritical point, or you have a phase, as it turns out, where they coexist. So it turns out, after some detailed analysis, we show that, in fact, they coexist in this particular case. The symmetry now is O4, in particular, in this system, or SO4, I guess. If you insist in having exact SO4 symmetry, the TC will actually be zero because you're in two dimensions. So in fact, having too much of fine-tuning is a problem because the actual TC will be completely suppressed. If you allow for some breaking of that, which is always present here, then it turns out that typically this is the phase diagrams that you find. Now, the moral of this is that all of these phases actually are an outgrowth, essentially, of the spin gap. So in a sense, the system begins with a large energy scale, which is a spin gap of individual ladders, and doesn't know what to do with it, and either makes a superconductor or a charge density wave or both. Okay? And in this case, you clearly have essentially, if you want, intertwined orders in the sense that the TCs are all more or less comparable to each other. So it's a good, simple example. Of course, if the doping is too large, you lose the gap, and you go into a Fermi liquid, and the TCs are all exponentially small here. So this is sort of a good case study, if you want, not for being realistic, but for understanding how these phases may arise. Well, let me close. Not with the questions, but with the recent result in the TJ model. Sorry about my. Okay, so I have a problem. I'll tell you the story. Okay, so there's a recent result in the TJ model by Corbeau's, Rice, and Troyer. They apply these tensor network methods that have become popular. They applied it to the two-dimensional TJ model, fairly large systems, and they find for a broad range of doping in that material, in that system, varying T and T prime, they also have T prime, that the system has three states for which they cannot distinguish which one is a ground state within the numerical error. One is the uniform D-wave superconductor, the other is this state, the pair density wave, and the third is a state where the two of them coexist. Let's call it the striped superconductor. if they apply a small amount of anisotropy, some nematicity code by hand, then the pair density wave wins back. So it appears that at least in some of these strongly correlated systems, some physics of this type is going on, at least from the point of view of ground state and of the ground state energy. The significance of the pockets that I mentioned before is an argument that was brought about, I think, by Patrick Lee recently, that even if these states are nearly degenerate, the pair density wave is favored from the point of view of the free energy, because now you have a finite density of states, so entropically it will be favored over the other ones. So it appears that these sort of strongly coupled states that locally look identical, because they all locally look like a D-wave superconductor, may actually be part of the explanation for why the phase diagrams have this complex structure with TCs which are more or less similar. But there is a lot of theory work that needs to be done, and much of what has been done is at the very qualitative level, except this work by Corvo and company. And I will stop here.
Thank you very much for this very interesting presentation.
Yes.
So, of course, in the coup rate, there's a lot of incommensurate. Does your theory
connect to your actually in that calculation?
Because you're talking about a period four.
No, in fact, I didn't assume the commensurability, okay. Otherwise, I would have to. There will be some commensurability energies and all that, which I know. I assume there was a commensurability. By the way, the other thing that this numerical calculation finds is that they actually vary. They are not naturally commensurate. Okay. Which was, otherwise, you would say, why is not a crystal, why is not an instrument?
I think this expression of the intertwined order,
yes.
I mean, maybe one can make it more precise and say intertwined channels. Because what you showed is that in certain cases, if I take on the view from, say, Parkett channels, then you might find preferred states at different channels that are sort of competitive, not competitive, but actually enforcing each other. And that has actually been seen in a lot of Parkett RG approaches. So then you would necessarily see that the spin density wave usually is quite large. It starts to grow first, and then sub-leading terms all appear in different channels. So, and you haven't shown us any case where within one channel you have intertwined order. You have only shown, if I recall correctly, you've only shown different channels that then end up having one.
Then they grow together.
Yeah.
Well, look, that's possible. We know examples in one dimension where, for instance, some of the early calculations trying to look for models of SO5 ended up having SO8 symmetry. I think this was done here by Matthew and Leon and a student way back then. So there is a long history of that. The problem is when you try to go to higher dimensions, then it becomes difficult, and then you need this concept of multiplicity to actually preserve that high degree of symmetry. So the point of this argument is that actually a high degree of symmetry is not a good thing, but to have lots of U1s, if you wish, it is a good thing. Yes?
Do you think some of this physics is special for lanthanum series?
I don't think so. In fact, first of all, in YBCO, this type of experiments have not been done. So, for instance, the Josephson resonance experiments haven't been done, and many of similar things. I think it's becoming clear also that there was some confusion whether the YBCO is involved bidirectional and unidirectional order. The more recent analysis by Damascelli shows that the order is always one-dimensional, unidirectional. So it's not out of question that the charge order that is seen has also a superconducting character of this type, at least at low temperatures. The answer to that is not there.
I think the doping dependence of the strike period is quite different than the lanthanum series. Yeah.
There are some differences.
But I mean, they are opposite.
There are differences.
They are opposite, right?
Yeah. In some regime, they are opposite. That's true. So, look, there are things which are generic, and other things which are not. So you have to understand there are some things which are specific to material, but it's still true that they always appear to go together, didn't they? Okay. And that's, I think, for me, is the important lesson. Okay.
So you mentioned that two-dimensionality helps.
Yes.
So my understanding is that you
quasi-dimensional.
You have already enclosed of your four parameters, a coupling constants. Then, if it were decoupling, if it were...
No, these are not logarithmic. These are not logarithmic.
But this is
DBT.
This is
DBT. Well, that's not well. Okay. So that, you get logarithmic flows near this point. In general, it's more complicated. You have relevant operators.
But so then, what kind of makes critical temperatures for all phases to be comparable, more compared to
Difference, and this is here. Essentially, the point is that these are the other parameters that couple the different regions are irrelevant, and so they lead to TCs that don't have which are not exponentially small in the coupling constant. So they have power loss in general, and depending on the pattern, they are more complicated. But or the pattern of order, they are more complicated. They are typically power loss with exponents of order unity, typically. So in that sense, the TCs are not small. So they are very non-BCS-like. So that's what working in this sort of quasi 1D picture from which where this was derived from essentially helps.
Further questions or comments? If this is not the case, we thank the speaker.